Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When children grow old enough to ask about death, many parents invoke a familiar story about this circle of life. They may explain that when we die, our bodies decompose and become the earth and the grass, which in turn gets eaten by the birds and the bugs, which are in turn eaten by larger animals, which will eventually die and become earth again, and so on and so on. While this explanation may be comforting, it is rarely accurate. Common burial practices and funeral traditions have long upended the natural process of death and decomposition by preserving bodies as long as possible. Our next guest says that's starting to change. Suzanne Kelly is the author of Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. She's going to be speaking at New England College in Concord tonight at 6:30. And Suzanne, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, how do modern funeral practices impede decomposition? And is that a side effect or a selling point?
Well, the standard American way of death really includes three things. It includes the use of chemical embalming fluid, the use of sealed hardwood and metal caskets, and the use of burial vaults. The embalming fluid, we know, is actually biodegradable, but it's also made up of the carcinogen formaldehyde, so it does pose a threat to worker health. And, of course, it works really well at preserving bodies, so that's the preservation component. And the sealed hardwood and metal caskets, there have been studies done in cemeteries that have shown to leach things like lead and cobalt and zinc into our cemetery lands. And then burial vaults are actually made up typically of reinforced concrete, but they're also sometimes made up of asphalt, which is a semi-solid form of petroleum, and sometimes plastic, which can also leach into the environment. Of course, all of these things serve as a kind of fortress to kind of keep the body from doing its thing, from decaying back into the elements. And that all started about 150 years ago. So.
Yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more on the history of that. When did we start using these kind of burial practices?
Yeah, you know, dust-to-dust practices, what we're calling green practices here, without the use of these three things, is really still largely practiced around the world, and it's the way that we used to bury our dead about 150 years ago. But that all started to change in the early 1800s when a rise in urban population actually collided with new fears around sanitation. This is when we saw diseases like cholera and yellow fever starting to spread through cities, and people were trying to figure out how to, you know, sort of stop them. And so reformers started to focus their attentions on things that smelled, dirty places in the culture. This was before we fully understood how germs actually got into the body and caused us to get sick, even die. And so they started to look at these smelly and sticky places, places of human waste and of garbage, and also our cemeteries, our graveyards. People were either buried on the back 40 at this time, or they were buried in towns and villages or emerging cities in church graveyards. These weren't places where people actually went to spend much time or visit the dead, and they weren't really well-kept places. Sometimes bodies were actually dug up to make room for other bodies. And eventually, towns and villages and cities started to place bans on burying bodies within these city and village and town limits. This gave rise to new rural cemeteries on the outskirts of town, which was really nice in a way because they were sort of the precursor to the parks movement in the U.S., but they were actually built on this erroneous fear that the dead body could actually cause us harm, could actually cause, you know, a sort of threat to public health. And, you know, even the World Health Organization, as recent as the 1980s, has been trying to get the public to realize that, for the most part, the dead body does not pose a danger to public health. There is no risk, for the most part. There are certain viruses like Ebola, for instance, which pose a great risk.
Well, so they were sealing these bodies and kind of sanctioning them off in another part of town. But how about embalming? When did that become popular and why?
Yeah, so that's the other really big piece of it. So that really started with the Civil War. Before that, we did not embalm at all, although embalming had been around for thousands of years in one form or another around the world. But in the U.S., embalming had really been seen as a fate worse than death. But with the Civil War, we had all of these soldiers from the North dying in the South, and families wanted burials for their sons, but how did you get all of these bodies back? Well, there were new anatomists on the scene who were hired by the Union Army, who were newly skilled in this practice of embalming. they were basically embalming cadavers so that they could study them. And so for families who could afford it, they actually embalmed bodies and sent them back home. Now, you would think that after the war ended that embalming would wither away too, but in fact, it only built up steam, and there were really two reasons for that. One is that in 1865, Abraham Lincoln's body was embalmed, and it was traveled across the country, and Americans were actually able to gaze upon it and gaze upon this new practice of preservation. And some historians actually point to this as a kind of symbolic overcoming, like a symbolic overcoming of a war that had parted a nation. So that was one reason. And then the second reason really had to do with the chemical companies that were creating these embalming fluids. They saw a business opportunity, and they started to set up workshops in schools to train folks in the new practice of embalming. Prior to this time, you know, death care was really an informal, was informal work that was largely done in the home, largely done by women who were kind of recognized in the community as having this knowledge. And with the advent of embalming, it became a much more formalized practice. It became a scientific practice where the actual scientific acumen of knowing how to embalm the body became sort of the purview of the funeral director, and those folks became our first funeral directors.
Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of paralleling an industrialization of a lot of things that used to be
exactly,
done at home.
Exactly.
So what is the ideal green burial?
Well, I think, you know, if you talk to green burial advocates, and, you know, I am one of many across the U.S. that have been growing in number over the last 15 years, the greenest way to go is, you know, whole body earth burial, which you know, some sort of a biodegradable container. It can be a pine box, it can be a cardboard box, it can be a shroud, it can be, you know, a family blanket, it can be a wicker casket. No burial vault and no embalming fluid. Of course, 50% of the U.S. population deaths anyway end in cremation. Those dispositions end in cremation. So the green burial movement also has to contend with the fact of cremation. It's on the rise. By 2030, it's estimated that 70% of the U.S. population will be cremated. And cremation, I think, is largely regarded by the movement as the second most environmentally sound way to dispose of the dead. If it's less than ideal, it's only because anytime you burn something, you pose a threat to soil, water, and air. And in parts of Europe, you know, they've done a much better job at placing better filters on their crematories to filter out things like dioxins and furans and mercury, actually, from dental fillings, and also to find more energy-efficient ways to fuel their crematories. But we have a long way to go in the U.S. with respect to those things.
Maybe you heard a little bit about the practices of green burial. Well, we're speaking with an expert, Suzanne Kelly. She's going to be speaking at New England College tonight, and she's author of a book called Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to Earth. Are there different safety issues that do need to be taken into consideration when it comes to this more natural green burial?
Well, you know, the states actually govern, each state governs their how cemeteries are set up. So if you would want to check with state guidelines for any kinds of regulations. But typically, you know, like in the state of New York where I am, you know, if you want to set up a cemetery, there are three ways to do it. One is if, you know, you're a religious organization. One's if you are a not-for-profit organization. And the other is if you're a municipality. And all of those have to abide by basic laws, which include a certain distance, certainly from bodies of water. That's a really big thing, and that was a big thing in our cemetery in particular. But, you know, and you have to have road access and that sort of thing so people can get in there. But in terms of safety regulations, I think water is the largest issue.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of lack of clarity. I mean, I'm just speaking anecdotally and with other people. My father passed away last year and wanted to be cremated. But it seemed that you had to have a funeral home come and pick him up. They had to handle, there had to be an intermediary, you know, sort of the funeral industrial complex, if I may say that, got involved. And he wanted simple. He'd gone through this with his parents, you know, that he was presented with all of these ornate caskets and given some sense of moral equivalency that the more you loved your parents, the more you'd spend on their funeral.
Right.
And wanted something much simpler. But people here don't know, can we keep a body inside of our homes to wake them? Can we bring somebody directly to the crematorium? Can we bury somebody in the ground in our own yards?
Yeah, so again, these are state-by-state regulations. There are 9 and possibly 10 states in the U.S. that actually impede a family to care for their dead on their own, and New York State happens to be one of those, and again, that's where I live. But most states actually do not get in the way of families' ability to actually care for their own dead, but families actually don't realize this. So, you know, you can have a home funeral. You know, you can have a viewing or a wake in your house. In New York State, you still can have all of those things, but the final disposition actually has to be overseen by a licensed funeral director.
Mm-hmm. So with people unsure about the legality or how involved they want to or have to be, as someone who is pro-green burial, how do you overcome that sort of resistance? You know, people don't know where they stand on this.
You know, this is not an industry movement that's happening right now. This is a grassroots movement that's really happening all throughout the U.S. right now, where people are sort of waking up to these practices, to these polluting and unsustainable practices, and really trying to reach back for lost knowledges that were once there, but that sort of got hidden beneath the surface. And so I think that, you know, the green burial movement, while there is resistance, it's sort of riding a tide right now of a new death awareness that really started with hospice and a focus on palliative care and elder law matters. And, you know, we see these death cafes popping up around the U.S. where people are getting together and, you know, drinking tea and eating cake and talking about death-related issues. And even the move toward, you know, home funerals with the development of the National Home Funeral Alliance, where, you know, 5 years ago, they've actually grown into a very strong organization. So while there is resistance and people don't necessarily know where they stand with respect to this, I think people are starting to feel empowered when it comes to death care in a new way, in a new age that we really haven't seen before. And it's happening on a lot of different levels.
Suzanne, green burial, like a lot of other green, quote unquote, movements, you know, seem to have two different sides. There's this practical side that wants to reduce harm to the environment wherever possible. And then there's a more philosophical or ideological side that decomposition is natural and good and humanizes our understanding of death as just part of life. In the green burial movement, is one more important than the other?
Well, you know, I try to get at some of these things in my book. I mean, I think that if you ask, you know, green burial advocates or anyone interested in green burial, you know, what's really the message of the movement, you're going to get a whole lot of different answers. You know, some people say that it's just a simpler process. Some people say it connects us back to the earth. Some people say it's a way of recycling ourselves. It's less expensive. It's more meaningful. It connects us to our communities in a deeper way. But I think that really underlying all of these is that it really expands the parameters of our land community and really gives us a way of thinking about ourselves in relationship to nature that we are really in dire need of. And I think if we look to, environmental thinkers like Aldo Leopold or Rachel Carson or even contemporarily like Vandana Shiva, in order to really change business as usual, we need to have practices that put us in direct relationship, right, that put us in partnership with the earth. And green burial practices are just sort of one more way that we can begin to do that.
Well, Suzanne, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Suzanne Kelly, she's author of Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. And she's going to be speaking tonight at New England College at their Concord Outpost. There's more information on the book and the event at wordofmouthradio.org.